following lecture was produced by the Gnostic Academy of Chicago, a nonprofit organization, and is one of many available for podcast, download, and transcription. You can visit chicagognosis.org to find courses, articles, scriptures, commentaries, and other valuable resources that address a wide variety of spiritual subjects, interests, and needs. Through the generous support of listeners like you, the Gnostic Academy of Chicago has produced online courses, lectures, and articles freely available worldwide. If you have benefited from this knowledge, help humanity through making a tax-deductible donation at chicagognosis.org. If you are interested in attending the Gnostic Academy of Chicago in person, you may view our online class schedule and freely register at meetup.com/chicagognosis. The Chicagoland Gnostic Academy provides humanity with the necessary means for transforming suffering and acquiring personal knowledge of the divine. With this purpose in mind, we now begin the lecture. May all beings be happy.
So this is the second in our series on the Gospel of Judas.
We've already explained how Judas is an archetype. He is a character in a drama. Historically, these figures were real people. But more importantly, in a narrative, they represent qualities in us. We all have Judas inside. We all have the robes of an apostle, of a religious person, a spiritual person, if we're attracted to these studies. But yet we still betray divinity in our mind, heart, and body. We already explained that Judas, historically the master, is a great initiate who played a role given to him by Christ that he did not want. He did not want to play the role of Judas, the betrayer, the ego, our pride and lust, which sells Christ for money, for pleasure. Judas in us represents really a part of our divinity as well. There's a multidimensional relationship here. Symbols are very compact. There are levels of interpretation. Judas in us is a tempter, but also there is a quality of divinity in us who gives us the ordeals we need to be tempted so that we can change. And this divine aspect of Judas really teaches us to go beyond good and evil, to transcend the worst in us. But obviously this is very controversial because the terms good and evil are very subjective. According to our philosophies, our religions, our beliefs, and even our personal lives, our morals. Good and evil is often a label for phenomena that puts us to sleep. We say this is good and this is bad, meaning this is convenient and this is inconvenient. But the reality is that often those things which are good for us spiritually are always the actions that are most inconvenient, the things that we have to push ourselves to do because we have many faults. We don't like friction psychologically, emotionally, socially. Most people do not like conflict. And yet, someone who becomes a spiritual revolutionary has to face it all the time with equanimity, with peace. This path that we study in our school is to become a being that is truly revolutionary, not in the political sense, spiritually, psychologically, to go against the grain, not merely in our daily life, in our jobs and careers, but in our mind stream. To go against what is easy. So Nietzsche wrote a book called Beyond Good and Evil. And his primary argument is that these terms are often very subjective and keep us enslaved. Enslaved to the past, not able to see the present, and not able to act for the future. The Gospel of Judas is precisely the path of going beyond good and evil in the subjective sense of the term. The term superhuman comes from Nietzsche, which Samuel uses a lot, Übermensch. Not merely a person who does whatever they want, but somebody who has divinity inside and is able to act for the welfare of humanity. And this is what we wish to become, a superhuman, a Christ, a rebel. This path is not easy. To become like Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad or Krishna or the initiates, it is very difficult to climb the mountain of initiation. But this is what we want to study in our school and what we practice and what we aspire to. Samuel Vero made some points about this in The Great Rebellion, how really we have to look at our own values. What is really good and what is really evil? Because in us, those principles tend to be mixed. What we think is good is actually evil. What we think is evil is actually good. To become a superhuman being, a superman, is not easy. There is no doubt that the road which leads to the superhuman is beyond good and evil. A thing is good when it suits us and bad when it does not. Within the rhythms of poetry, crime is also concealed. There is much virtue in the villain and much evil in the virtuous. Nobody is ever just black and white. We're a mixture. And in fact, when we think we are praying, maybe for a car or for money or whatever it may be, as a superficial sense, as an example, we are really engaging in crime because we desire things that are not good for us or what we need or what divinity knows we can get in accordance with the responsibilities of life. So our values psychologically really can be dangerous in the sense that we take life for granted. We think that what we think and feel and do in life, in terms of our moment-to-moment awareness, we don't question our desires. We take life for like a drama or comedy or tragedy, whatever it may be. And really, we don't question our agency in the midst of it. What is really compelling us to behave in the ways we do, to think and feel and act in life the way we are, not understanding that we can change and that we are merely a seed in potential spiritually. The values of good and evil, as described by Samuel Vior and also the Gospel of Judas, are really roadblocks. The concepts, the values, the ideas. And this is a thorny road philosophically, but also psychologically and spiritually. Because rather than accept that such and such a behavior is bad or good, we have to know in ourselves. We have to judge in our mind what good and evil really is. What is good for a demon is bad for an angel. What is bad for an angel is good for a demon. And unfortunately, we are all demons. Not merely with pitchfork and horns and a certain physical appearance, a black magician, a sorcerer. Really, a demon is a being with lust, pride, hatred, fear, vanity, attachments, all that we carry within. And these senses of self hypnotize us into a slumber where we don't question the process. So, morality, often for most people, is based on this. What we think is good is often based on our pride and anger. Superficially, you look at culture today, American media, what do people worship? What do religions worship now? Perhaps a statue, something dead, because the ideals of the religion are there, but the living spark of faith is lost in the community and in the high priests. So if we wish to transcend good and evil, we have to be willing to give up what we think in terms of morality, in the sense that rather than judge intellectually this is good or bad, we have to follow our conscience, our heart, because some actions produce suffering and some don't. And some actions, even though if we are awake spiritually and we give to the community, there may be friction, but it may be the right thing. It's not a black and white issue. There's nuance in every interaction and relationship. And therefore, having a moral sense of, I have to do this all the time and this none of the time. Meanwhile, situations depends on the context too. Some cases it's relative. Maybe I have to behave in this way. Maybe I don't. Obviously, there are certain behaviors that, spiritually speaking, can produce a lot of harm. But here we're talking about the social domain, knowing how to act and live. This is why Salman Vior said in The Great Rebellion, the road which leads to the superhuman is the path of the razor's edge, because it is a fine line to walk the path of conscience, knowing what to say and do and think and be and respond to ordeals in life. This path is filled with perils from both within and without. Evil is dangerous and good is also dangerous. The frightening path is beyond good and evil. It is terribly cruel. Any moral code can detain us on our way toward the superhuman. Attachments to such and such yesterdays, to such and such scenes, can halt us on the road which leads to the superhuman. So how can good be dangerous? If you study this tradition for some time, you hear about astral projections, dream yoga, jinn experiences, out-of-body experiences, meditative states. You may have that experience for some time, and then we get attached. Oh, I'm spiritual because I had that this experience, and then we get stuck. We don't change. We don't grow. Attachments to yesterday is what keeps us asleep and in pain. But a superhuman, a divine master, a master of oneself, is somebody who can distinguish good from evil and evil from good. Any circumstance, whether it is maybe appalling or challenging or painful, there is good and evil and good. Perhaps we may encounter someone who's very, you know, provoking our pride, maybe at work, our careers, our jobs. But yet we learn to take the opportunity of the challenge, the ordeal, and make something good of it. It's a delicate process, knowing how to decipher through the sands and the mud and the dirt to find the gems. Discernment is like a sword. It cuts through illusion and arrives at truth. And that sword is the word of divinity, the superhuman, whom we call the Christ man, the Christ human. So, Salman Vior elaborates on these points, that our ideas and our traditions and our attachments to such and such yesterdays can keep us in the past, but that we have to discern and extract what we need for our development. However wise norms and procedures may be, they can obstruct us in our progress toward becoming a superhuman if they are bottled up in this or that fanaticism, in this or that prejudice, or in this or that idea. The superhuman can distinguish good from evil and evil from good. He grasps the sword of cosmic justice and is beyond both good and evil. Doesn't matter the group, the fanaticism. It can be in Gnosis. It can be in any religion. The idea that we know, but we don't. So we have to be constantly reevaluating ourselves. Well, I'll jump into the actual Gospel of Judas, now that we know some of the principles behind it, that can help us understand this scripture. So Judas, as we explained, the master, represents, really, our ego, who betrays us moment by moment. But here we see the historical master Judas approaching the prophet, the master Jesus, asking for guidance. He basically wants to attain the highest divinity, but for that he has to be willing to give up what he thinks is good. Now obviously from the Gospel of Judas and the story of Judas, we know he was the master or the apostle who betrayed Christ. And yet he played a role, not because he wanted to betray his Lord, but because Jesus commanded it. And so what's interesting is that Judas, the master, asked for consolation. I wish to go to the heights with you, to the highest divinity, the absolute truth, which is beyond and transcendent, beyond any value. And yet Jesus says, basically, you will suffer, basically, because you need to give up what you think is good. And you have to be willing to renounce it. And obviously, this is a very high level of mastery. Judas represents a very high level of mastery because he must learn to transcend even his own sense of piety and righteousness and goodness, his love for Jesus, and that this involves renunciation. Renunciation is the path towards transcendence, to give up what we are for something beyond our current attachments and values. Jesus understood that Judas was contemplating the rest of what is lofty, and he said to him, "Move away from the others, and I shall explain to you the mysteries of the kingdom, not so that you can attain it, but you will go through a great deal of grief, for somebody else will take your place, so that the 12 disciples may be complete again, once again with their God." So again, as the most controversial apostle, he actually is the highest historically, because he played a role that no one else was willing to do. And yet here he says, as a type of initiate, "I want to go to the heights." He says, well, you must be willing to give up everything. And you will suffer for it, because it is not easy. To reach the heights, we call it, in Gnostic terms, the 13th aeon. So if you've studied the Tree of Life in the Kabbalah, we have an image that we're going to go into great detail. Especially at the top of this mystical glyph, we find levels of divinity and abstraction from the highest above down to the most material below. The absolute is above this Tree of Life, above Keter, the crown of divinity. The Ain, the Ain Sof, the Ain Sof 4. 10 spheres and 13 levels or abstractions above. 13 aeons. The 13th is precisely the very source of all being, the absolute, from which Jesus emerged. The Gnostics referred to the heights of divinity as Barbello, the region of fire and light. And so Jesus came from the 13th aeon, and Judas wishes to return to the 13th aeon. Some may reach the 12th, but not the 13th, because there are requirements for each degree. And to go beyond the 12th aeon, like the 12 apostles, one has to renounce one's good. But that's obviously a very high level, you know, very, very subtle to comprehend, but also to reach. So Jesus represents that light which emerged from that source. And he explained to the disciples who questioned him, the apostles, "Where did you come from? Where have you gone?" Because if you meet Jesus, say, in an astral projection, he basically can go from any dimension at will, from the very heights to the very, you know, earth. He's like light, literally like a bolt of light that can go from any dimension, anywhere. He has a level of mastery, which is really incomprehensible. He sees all the dimensions of nature, level by level. He's able to navigate them at will and can show you, you know, levels of, you know, truths and mysteries in the dream state. But he comes from that region. And the disciples, so mention this to him. They ask him in the scripture. The next day in the morning, Jesus appeared to his disciples. They said to him, Master, where did you go? And what did you do when you departed from us? Jesus said to them, I went to a different generation, one that is great and holy. Have you ever seen Renaissance paintings of Jesus ascending and the clouds parting and going in like a light to the origin? And all the apostles looking up in awe, not able to comprehend his majesty. That's something you can experience in the astral plane. Literally goes up and the clouds part. And that's an accurate depiction of his level of mastery, showing that he can go from the earth to the heavens in an instant. Very powerful and divine. So he's teaching Judas that he came from this top unknown source. Ein means nothing. Ein Sof means limitless. Ein Sof 4 means limitless light. So we talk about Kabbalah to explain levels of mastery and levels of divinity. So Elohim is a term used to name God in the Bible. And Elohim is the unknown divinity. So Elohim are all the angels, masters, prophets, Buddhas, saints, gods, spirits, initiates who have, you know, master the tree of life. They've developed even the top trinity in themselves. And yet, they are still waiting to enter higher levels of mastery within the absolute. So the tree of life, you could say, is a manifested glyph. It's like a map of the manifested universe. It's the levels of nature and divinity that we can access in this, you know, state of cosmic manifestation. But the source is unmanifested. It's a divine potential which is not yet actualized into being. And that there's a bit of a threshold there in order to go from the manifested to the unmanifested. And that's the difference between Elohim and I-Elohim. Or to refer to the Gnostic Gospels, you have the Demiurge, who governs the universe, Elohim. And then Agnostos Theos, the unknown God, I-Elohim. So that generation that the Lord Jesus mentioned is the Ayin, the nothing, the cosmic space from which all worlds emerge. The disciples said to him, Lord, what is that great or the great generation that is exalted over us and is holy, but is not present in these realms? Because you have manifested reality, unmanifested reality. And remember that the apostles asked, where did you go? Because they can't follow him. They're like a light that just goes to heaven. Right? So they can't follow him because they're not at that level. But Judas seeks to follow in his footsteps in the gospel. When Jesus heard these things, he laughed and said to them, why are you reflecting in your minds about the generation that is powerful and holy? You may long for it, but why are you theorizing about it? Why do you think about it? Do it. But that's the challenge, right? So the way to approach those heights is through the direct path. Straight is the gate and narrow is the way that leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it, from the Gospels. The direct path is a path taken by masters who seek to renounce all that they are to go beyond good and evil. We call them bodhisattvas in Buddhism. A bodhisattva, an initiate who has the light of Bodhi, Christ, incarnated, and now is perfecting themselves in their mastery. But to really go beyond that point, really upon obtaining mastery, we can say, if you study the Tree of Life, a master is some initiate who has reached Tifereth with some level of development, the middle of the tree. They've conquered these lower spheres, Malkut, Yesod, Ha, Netzach, Tifereth, levels of nature. They've worked with the perfect matrimony, and they have a level of understanding of these regions. And yet, if they wish to go to the top, and then beyond. They have to be willing to go beyond good and evil. Because Christ, the intimate Christ, our inner divinity, our inner light, is beyond our concepts of good and evil. And that light is very radical, which is why in the lives of the prophets, they were so controversial. Nobody understands them. Nobody understood them. And yet they had the power to lead because their source comes from Barbello. And that way to behold that generation, that sphere, that emanation, that Sephira, or the Sephiroth, the emanations of the Tree of Life, one has to really die psychologically. Die to pride, die to anger, die to lust, die to fear. I tell you the truth, no one born of this realm will behold that generation. No angelic host of stars will rule over that generation. No human of mortal birth will be able to accompany it. Even the angels cannot go into the absolute unless it is the command of the highest. They have to work after many cosmic eras, after they've reached a level of self-realization to be able to reach that point. But obviously, they get that, they enter that, really the heights when they have earned it. And that's what the path that Judas is taking to be able to reach that point. And no human of mortal birth will be able to accompany it. We're all born through our parents. And really, our parents gave birth to our body through lust. I mean, we may love our partner, or our parents may have loved each other, but the act itself was not an immaculate conception in the sense of how to use the sexual energy to create. Was it used just to satisfy passion, or was it used to create the spirit? And so all of us, if we wish to go to the very heights, eventually our body must die. And that's a path that happens at near the very end of the work as we're climbing the Tree of Life, when even our physical body needs to go to the grave so that we can, the soul, after perfecting itself, can go up. No human of mortal birth. We have to be giving birth. We have to be giving birth spiritually. So, in this path of Judas, to take the path of Judas begins really, as I said, with mastery in Tifereth, where upon reaching the middle of the Tree of Life, what is called the causal world, one has a choice, as depicted within the Mona Lisa of Da Vinci. Mona Lisa, the Divine Mother. She appears before the initiate. You've reached mastery. You are born again. You have created vehicles of the soul. You have the garments of the divine wedding, the wedding garments of the spirit. Or in Arabic, in the Quran, libas al-taqwa, the garments of reverence. Many names for the garments of love, according to Rumi. And she says, you wish to take, you have two choices, basically. Stay in heaven, Tifereth, or renounce heaven and go beyond. Go beyond good and evil. Two paths behind Mona Lisa. One entering into the waters and one going beyond. Spiral and straight paths. The spiral path is a slow path of development, staying within the heavenly regions, enjoying a beautiful vacation, which actually is much longed for. And it's very difficult to renounce that level of good where you're happy, you have powers, you're in heaven, you're eating grapes all day on couches of luxury in a spiritual sense. And even the Quran mentions many times that in the garden of bliss, you have women of divine origin, the Auris and the Nirvanis, the gods, walking you on couches of silk and brocade. Brocade, did I get that right? And much bliss, but to go beyond that is the next level. Two paths. The spiral path takes many cosmic eras to go to the source. Very little difficulty. But the straight path is to renounce everything we are, go beyond good and evil, deny ourselves, and to go to the heights with expediency. very quickly, but very difficult, because all the past karma and things that we owe, our debts spiritually, come to us. And that's why you see the lives of the prophets were so challenging. They faced one ordeal after the other, after the other. And with that challenges, they gained mastery. You are before two paths. The first path is the logoic path, the path of starry skies, the spiral path of the firmament. The second is the long path of bitterness and woe that takes us to the very gates of the absolute. But that's a choice that one makes when one's at that level. Obviously, this is very elevated, right? I mean, very profound. But it's good to know what will happen if we reach that point. And the Gospel of Judas can also apply to many elements in us at our current level as beginners. Judas is referred to as the 13th daemon in the Gospel of Judas. 13th Aeon, 13th Daemon, Arcanum 13 of the Tarot. The 13th Arcanum of the Tarot among the Gnostics is immortality, death. Death of lust to give birth to chastity, purity. Death of pride to give birth to humility. The death of fear to give birth to confidence in God. This initiate in the card reaps wheat. But to reap wheat, we must use the scythe of death. Cut clean what needs to be cut clean, our defects. And so Judas, in the gospel, basically asks, I've had a vision. I wish to follow you to the very heights, but the problem becomes, what needs to die? What do we need to renounce? What needs to change? So we see here that Judas represents the principle of death, the death of our defects. Judas said, "Master, just as you have listened to all of them, now also listen to me, for I have seen a powerful vision." Jesus heard this, then laughed, and he said to him, "O 13th daemon, why are you so excited? Speak your mind then, and I will hear you out." So the daemon in this sense means spirit, kind of like Socrates' daemon, you know, his voice of conscience in the Apologia that guided him moment by moment. That voice is what helps us follow the path of immortality, death of the impure, and give birth to the soul. So what is this vision of Judas in the Gospels? So Judas has a vision of life really beyond good and evil, of the heights, of the very highest degrees of mastery. I'll relate this vision that he had, and I'll explain some points about it because it's very profound. In synthesis, there are masters who achieve development of these top spheres of the Tree of Life, the Trinity of all religions, and even enter Ein Sof 4, the Limitless Light, and the Ein Sof, the Origin, or one more degree below the very heights. And the Ein Sof, meaning limitless, in synthesis, is like a spark. It's like a divine atom from the absolute. So there's a cosmic space from which we all emerged. But all of us have a super divine atom, like a synthesis, a spark of light and being, which is in the void, which emanates in the eternal, the limitless, because it is limitless joy, real being, real peace. So if you synthesize everything that you extract everything that is superfluous from us, get rid of the fake and the artificial, layer by layer, up the Tree of Life, you finally arrive at the light, the Star of Bethlehem, that guided the three magi. That star is the Ein Sof. There are masters who reach that level, and that's very high and very beautiful, and that is the level of an Elohim, of a real angel. But even beyond that, there's something more. Judas said unto him, Jesus, "I have seen myself in the vision as the 12 disciples were stoning me and treating me harshly. And I also came to the place that," some of the text has not been preserved after you, "I saw a house and my eyes could not grasp its dimensions." We know from Kabbalah, the Jewish mystical tradition, that Ein Sof is Bet, the second Hebrew letter, meaning house. Bet Lehem, house of bread. The Star of Bethlehem, is the Ein Sof. That is our real house, our home from which we emerge. Even the Wizard of Oz correlates with this myth, symbolically, Kabbalistically. I wish I was home. She comes from, you know, the divine origins and then goes to really the whole journey of that folk tale. Bethlehem, house of bread. And Judas wishes to go there. It's very wonderful and beautiful and peaceful. I saw a house and my eyes could not grasp its dimensions. Important people moved around it. That house had a thatched roof, and within the house there was a crowd. Master, let me also come in with these people. Because to return to Ein Sof with wisdom and knowledge is beautiful. But Jesus warns him, don't get stuck there. Go beyond. This is the difference between Elohim and I Elohim. Elohim means gods and goddesses, the architect demiurge. I Elohim means without, beyond, even the gods. Jesus answered and said, your star has deceived you, Judas. Not that the light, in a sense, betrays us, but that there is more for you if you are willing. So the way of Judas is the way of going beyond good and evil. Obviously, in our current state as beginners, we really want to overcome evil, especially because we may have a lot of anger and resentment and negative emotions, pride, behaviors that are harmful. In a sense, Saman Vira mentions that as we're eliminating certain defects in our work, we usually go for the bad ones first, right? Because they're most destructive. And then later, upon becoming a master, one has to annihilate the egos of good, right? Even egos that know how to be altruistic and kind, but they're not divine. So Jesus explains to Judas the requirements of entering the Ein Sof, and that it's meant for the saints. It's a level of sainthood, mastery, perfection. But in reality, don't get comfortable. No person of mortal birth is worthy to go into the house you have seen. That place is kept for the saints, where sun and moon will not rule, nor the day, but they will stand there always in the eternal realm with all holy angels. Sun and moon are alchemical symbols, male, female, positive, negative, masculine, feminine, light and darkness. And a level of being of the Ein Sof, it's, you know, as approaching the heights, it's a level of equilibrium going beyond our ideas of good and evil. But the perfection, the absolute perfection is involved when we transcend even angelhood. I believe even Rumi mentioned in a poem, I must sacrifice even my angel self, for unto him shall all return. Some principles we can kind of wrap things up with from Igneous Rose by Saman Vior is the qualities of discernment, of knowing to distinguish and discriminate between good and evil, positive, negative, as beginners. Learn to separate the smoke from the flames. In everything that is good, there is something evil. In everything that is evil, there is something good. You have now passed beyond good and evil. You now know the goodness of evil and the evilness of good. Offense is hidden within the instance of prayer. Right? Evil can wear the robes of a martyr. Anger can wear the robes of a judge. Oh, I was right to get angry, right? I mean, pride can wash its hands clean, like Pilate. And Caiaphas, out of religious piety, can tear his vestures in anger and blasphemy over a seeming infraction. Flames are light. Smoke, we have to separate and distinguish good from evil. And that only comes about by following the path of meditation. And this path, obviously, this fine refinement of who we are is very difficult. It's very lonely because it doesn't involve, even if we are married, doesn't involve, you know, the other person doing the work for us. They help. A marriage can really bolster us and give us the necessary fire and energy to work, but that by itself is not enough. And so in the Gospel of Judas, they synthesize how really, if you've studied the works of Salman Vior, the creative energy itself that we've talked about again and again, working with a sexual force and a marriage, the seed, which can give birth to the soul, has to be used for, or really transformed with the conscience, the consciousness. So Judas, obviously, while going up the tree, wants to, tree of life, wants to develop his soul, his seed, to that height. Judas said, "Master, is it possible that my seed is subject to the rulers?" And if you study the Gnostic Gospels, the archons or rulers are all the different divinities that govern the different Sephiroth levels of nature with different laws. They enact the laws of being in those spaces. And Judas is asking, will my energy, will my soul be subject to them, these laws of the demiurge, architect? Jesus answered and said to him, come that I may, some verses are obviously from the original, weren't translated because of the scroll itself. But you will go through a great deal of grief when you see the kingdom in its entire generation. There is a myth in the book of, or the Bible, when Moses sees the promised land but does not enter. It's the same metaphor, where you shall see that generation, but you shall not go into it thereat. You shall see the bliss of those, you know, higher regions, but you will not enjoy rest, because as a bodhisattva, you will sacrifice yourself for multiple humanities through great aeons of time, again and again, until finally earning the right to emerge in the bosom of Elohim, the supreme divinity. And this is why the last shall be first and the first last. Right? From the Gospels. Those who put others' good ahead of them and not their own, those last shall be first. And the first, those who seek or maybe are attached to, what is it, benefits and pride in the moment, will in turn not enter the heights. So Judas questions the whole utility of the highest direct path, because why should I follow this if it's going to take a long time, right? Or it's going to be a difficult process. When Judas heard these things, he said to him, "What advantage is there for me since you have set me apart from that generation? What will I benefit by being stoned and hated and persecuted, even by the masters who still have ego?" Jesus answered and said, "You will be the 13th, and you will be cursed by the other generations, but eventually you will rule over them. In the last days they will, up to the holy generation." So obviously you see historically from the Master Judas that he was really persecuted and hated, because he had to play the role that no one wanted to do. And yet, Salman Vior mentions that historically this master is preparing to enter the Ayin. He's currently serving in the Klipot, the hell realms, teaching the lost souls, the demons. And really, Salman Vior said, "I am not even worth kissing the sandals of the feet of Judas for the work he does or is doing. And if anyone has the right to enter the Ayin, it's him." In conclusion, there's some resources we have on our website which teach about how to practically apply the path of Judas. So I know I talked some abstract things like what does it mean to go beyond good and evil? What is good and evil in our lives? The way that we learn it is through meditation, discernment. By meditating and comprehending our own thoughts, feelings, will, desires, impulses, behaviors, actions, ways of being, we can discern what's true and what's false. And then we learn to comprehend and learn to eliminate what needs to go. So the main practice we use is meditation, especially an exercise called retrospection. And retrospection meditation basically involves reviewing your day and visualizing what defects did you see in yourself, and systematically meditating, comprehending them, going deep. I suggest if you wish to learn more about it, and just for the sake of time here today, you can reference the course. We have it available in the PDF and the slides, which will be on our website too. So at this point, I open up the floor to questions.
Sure.
Yeah, you mentioned Demirut.
Yes.
And it's different with Yaldabaoth.
Yaldabaoth, yeah. So Yaldabaoth is an interesting symbol too. I mean, that name Yaldabaoth is a composite.
Yaldabaoth created the world.
Yeah, so in one sense,
Demirut did.
Yeah, so Yaldabaoth is literally means children of the void. In one sense, Yaldabaoth, above, the host above, is the Demiurge, the angels that created the heavens and the earth. But there's also hell. And there is a region of nature, the inversion of the tree of life, where when all those forces go down into more levels of complexity, you have the hell realms. The inversion of the tree of life. In Islam, we call it the tree of Zakum, the tree of death. And Yaldabaoth, when those forces of divinity are channeled through hell, you have the children of that void, which are all the demons or archons of the infernal worlds. It's a dual symbol.
So Yaldabaoth is the son of Sophia.
Well, Yaldabaoth is, in some myths, is the above, as you know, the Demiurge architect which created the universe, which is the tree of life. But the problem becomes, when interpreting the Gnostic Gospels, which Yaldabaoth are we referring to? Because some people conflate the two. Like, they look at the scriptures and see, oh, the archons and the, you know, the
Lord Archons.
Yeah, the Lord Archons or the Demiurge sounds evil because it's oppressing Sophia. Sophia is the soul. And the soul wants to return to the 13th Aeon. Sophia is the consciousness which must awaken. But Sophia is obviously troubled. But the problem too is, you know, when Sophia is ascending up that journey through initiation, the archons resist. Meaning those hierarchs, really of the higher worlds, say no. Meaning the heavenly archons of these higher spheres of the tree of life are basically saying, if you wish to enter those regions, you have to renounce yourself. You have to pay what you owe. And they block the door and they resist. There's that level of meaning. But sometimes when we see Sophia being oppressed by these lustful, degenerate archons, it's referring to the lower hell realms. So it's nuanced. I mean, you have to kind of discern, which archons are we talking about? The archons of heaven, the hierarchs of heaven, the hierarchs below. And Yaldabaoth is that symbol of all those beings, whether in heaven or hell, in different levels of nature. Depends where we're at. Sure.
When you're talking about the great architect or Elohim, are we considered at some level of ego? Like they have like some percentage of ego,
right,
referring to the aim that doesn't have anything?
Yeah, so obviously there are masters who are at the beginning. In the beginning of mastery, one still has a lot of ego, a lot of pride, a lot of fear, a lot of anger, a lot of lust. And what happens is that, you know, those archons, maybe those masters of that level may have some purity, but they still have work to do. Obviously, in the higher levels, there's no ego. But in the beginnings of mastery, there is. This is described in the Bible as the three kings. Black king, white king, yellow king. Or to use Book of Kings, or was it Saul, David, Solomon. Black, psychologically meaning ego. King of nature, a master, but still impure. You see in the Bible that Saul had many problems in Israel. David, maybe less so, because he conquered his enemies. His own ego, no defect. And then the perfected, resurrected master, Shlomo, solar man, Solomon. But yeah, I mean, there's levels of application. The higher you go, there's no less ego. to the point that there is none. But sometimes, yeah, you hear in the Greek myths of the gods who go to battle with each other, who constantly fight. It's because they have pride. And you see this in the Gnostic movement, or any religion, really, where people have some position or, you know, they're leading, and yet there's different egos and defects involved. So it's sometimes the gods fight among themselves. The masters fight among themselves. But the perfected masters don't really, they're beyond that. And they can guide effectively, because that's why we have hierarchy, levels of development. And that's mapped out by the Tree of Life. Yeah. Sure.
So the Gospel of Judas was removed from the original text. Now, why was it removed like this? Because this knowledge is very controversial for Christians who let's say, they use Judas as the scapegoat disciple. And I've always wondered about this, because how could Jesus choose someone who does not have a role to play?
That's the difference between the orthodoxy and the heterodoxy. In the early Christian movements, there were many Gnostic groups, many Gnostic group or Christian groups, or many Gnosticisms. Even Marvin Meyer in the Nag Hammadi, his commentary, says it's actually erroneous to say that there's one Gnostic movement at the time. There were many groups with competing intentions, and it kind of reflects what's going on today, you know, with any movement. What's interesting is that as Catholicism gained ground, or the Orthodox Christian tradition, meaning the more mainstream Christianity, was forming, you found that you had a group of people who were not initiates who were selecting texts. So they're discerning, does this fit what we understand or believe about Christ? And obviously with the level of interpretation comes the level of judgment. And Dion Fortune explained very beautifully that the underground Christian movements, really the Gnostics, had to flee from the public life, because as the Orthodoxy formed, they were being persecuted, or were persecuting the Gnostics, which is why the Gnostics basically went underground. They kept their scriptures hidden, and only by the grace of God do we have them now. And even then, what we have is a minor fragment of what actually was available. I mean, Marvin Meyer mentioned something like, you know, really this, what we have available is like almost nothing compared to what existed. And so people eliminate what doesn't fit the narrative. So that's the problem. And you got to think, people obviously don't accept Judas as a master because it requires basically a one interpretive move, that the Gospels themselves are a story, not merely literal history. Even though those figures existed, they taught through their life what we need to do. And the problem is that if you can't disassociate Judas from historically with what he represents in us, really that's the first hurdle of going from mainstream religion to initiation. It's understanding that these symbols represent our own life. But that's the challenge. Yeah, people don't like the easy interpretations, right? Or people like the easy interpretations. They don't like friction. You know, it's not comfortable for most people to be challenged, right? Even in our beliefs, even in Gnostic beliefs, even no matter what religion, because it requires us to really reflect in ourselves, what do we really know? What have we experienced? Yeah.
Is Judas and Jesus the only people that we kind of know that have reached that 13th level? Have there been other masters that have been able to get to the highest level?
Yeah, there are many, but we know of Jesus, and Salman Vera mentioned that Judas is on his way. Okay. But I believe even he mentions in the end of the book, The Narrow Way, The Passion of Mansur al-Halaj, and that he was marching on the diamond path, going to the absolute. Yeah, beautiful story. He gives a whole excerpt in the end of that book, The Narrow Way. He says, Mansur, or al-Halaj, is marching on the angelic path. He's ready to go, you know? Great Sufi.
Wow.
Yeah. And obviously there's more. Yeah, I mean, there's many more. We don't know their names because, I mean, you look at the stars in the sky. Do we have names for all of it? Yeah, it's hard to put a finger on it, but we have a few that we know of.
Is there a way to recover the original text from like the Akashic records or something? And it's credible?
Yeah, I mean, if you are a competent enough, capable enough meditator, you can put your body to sleep, go in the astral plane, ask your divinity, show me what I need to see about Judas or Buddha or Moses or Muhammad, and literally you'll see, even you may even take on the role of those figures. Because what happens is that you really, even not so, more so the Akashic records, but you're gonna have an experience in Chokmah, which is the world of universal being. In our terms, we call it Christ, the second logos. And what happens in that level of nature is like, there's no individuality there, super individuality. I remember one instructor mentioned from Glorian who was meditating, and then he saw himself as Krishnamurti teaching students. And then he returned to his body and says, what was this? I'm not Krishnamurti. Let me go back again. Did it again. Found that he was a student's different perspective. And then he realized he was having a vision in Chokmah where he was one and everyone. And also Akashic records too. And in the astral plane, you can literally see play out like a movie where you may even be a participant or a spectator at the same time, living out what happened in the Middle East. You know, and the Akashic records are like a office, or like a filing office with a secretary, and it's like, you know, the files, you know, symbolically, you can ask that question, like, what is the Akashic records? And you can see, like, it's like going to an office and like, okay, you want to extract a certain file? Here's what happened. And you live it, you see it. Sure.
The Akashic records, does that mean that you can ask for a record of like whatever you wish to inquire about, or do you submit a request and a higher level being gives you what you need at that time, and that's how that works?
Yeah, Akashic records is like, the term Akasha comes from Sanskrit, and Akasha is a substance that permeates the astral plane. It's like a light, or almost gives the dream state its surreality, its kind of oniric or, you know, powerful emotional impact, like the light we perceive in dreams, or the kind of depth and color that when our dreams are very vibrant. It's the astral light, Akasha. And Akasha is like a film. Every action we perform physically, mentally, emotionally, psychologically is imprinted. If you've ever done photography, you know, basically you expose light to the film, makes an imprint, and then you can see it played out. So what happens is like Akashic records is like you see literally, you experience it through a vision. And sometimes that could be facilitated by a master, or like they may come and tell you certain things, but more importantly, it's like you suddenly, like you're actually in a, you ask for, see the life of Jesus. Suddenly you may be in a room and Jesus is like teaching, and you can actually live it and see it as in you're face to face. So it's better than going to or reading a book, because the books can be wrong. You know, historically, there's just so much gap between time, and then, you know, materialistic scholarship is good as a baseline. But Akashic investigation is much more profound. You know, you actually can see what things that were never written about, which are very deep. And Saman Vira gave some examples in his book, The Major Mysteries. I believe he mentions the Narrow Way as well. In The Narrow Way, he mentions what happened between the ages of his teenage years to when he was 33, described his life, because he actually saw it in the Akashic records and documented it.
The Accordion Gospel?
No, it's The Narrow Way, formerly translated as The Doomed Aryan Race. Any more questions?
When we are talking about getting the Akasha records, I have heard that it's better to do it yourself than not going with someone who can help you provide the meditation, because sometimes you can, especially if you're like a beginner, you can face like this meditation with demons, and they show you what they want you to do.
Yeah.
So if it, I don't know if it's better to do it by your own or go with someone who, because the thing is that doesn't make sense to me that they charge for this. So.
And obviously that's the red flag. And then honestly, we want to encourage investigation for ourselves. I mean, it's basically we want to teach ourselves to be self-reliant. We don't want to be dependent on anyone spiritually. Yeah, the key is we want to be independent investigators of these phenomena. We don't want to rely on other people because we don't know their qualifications or if they're telling us the truth. So the only way to know is to do it oneself.
So this is done by meditation.
Yeah, dream yoga, you train your body, you're meditating, you enter a meditative state, you fall asleep, you go into the dream world, and you ask divinity, show me what I need to see. And that can help us see like maybe the history of even of like Judas, right? Which clarifies, the path for us. And that way we don't have to really rely on books. I mean, books are good, they have their utility and purpose, but it's better to become conscious investigators.
Let your intuition be your guide.
Conscience, and again, going back to the lecture, intuition, conscience, knowing right from wrong in your heart. I mean, people can tell you believing in our church, our tradition, our school is good. That if you don't follow this, you're evil. I mean, that's a very, I mean, it's a caricature, but some people really do think like this. So it's like, you got to think, going beyond good and evil, it's like, well, how do you know? Your heart.
To learn more about the knowledge covered in this lecture, we invite you to study the books available through Glorian Publishing or GnosticTeachings.org. You can also view free online courses, lectures, transcriptions, and articles available at ChicagoGnosis.org. All of this is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Have you benefited from this knowledge? Help others by making a tax-deductible donation at ChicagoGnosis.org. We thank you for listening. We hope that these lectures aid you in developing your complete and divine potential. May all beings be happy. May all beings be joyful. May all beings be in peace.